Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. Are you worried about democracy? I have to confess, I am a bit worried about democracy. That's why I listen to a wonderful podcast called Democracy Works. It's run by the fabulous people at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. The podcast aims to rise above partisan politics and the daily news grind to take a broader look at issues impacting democracy. These are things we cannot ignore. You can go to www.democracyworkspodcast.com and subscribe in all kinds of ways, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other places. We really love this podcast at the NBN, and so much so that we are going to provide you with a little taste of what you can get at Democracy Works. I hope you enjoy the following episode.
From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy on the campus of Penn State University, I'm Michael Berkman.
And I'm Chris Beam, and this is Democracy Works.
Chris, we're not coming from the studios of WPSU today. Rather, we're at the McCourtney headquarters in Pond Lab.
Yeah, it sounds more impressive than it is. But here we are. Best way to interview our guest, who I will now introduce. We're talking to James Miller today. He's a professor at New School in New York, and he just wrote a book, really interesting book, called Can Democracy Work? A Short History of a Radical Idea from Ancient Athens to Our World. And it's just a series of kind of historical vignettes about what democracy meant in ancient Athens, what it meant in the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution, and then how it's kind of evolved through America. And, you know, he's really kind of chasing this idea of what is democracy and what does it mean and how do we actually kind of make it work.
Yeah, really erudite and interesting look at how democracy differs over time mm-hmm. and across space.
Right, and really just an impressive breadth of knowledge. I mean, you know, we know this stuff, and I think both of us were really educated by what's in this book. And so it's very interesting because, you know, he comes at this as someone from with a kind of radical background who's just stepping back and looking at wait a minute, what do we mean when we say democracy? What do we mean when we say, popular sovereignty, people power?
And what do we mean when we refer to liberal democracy?
Right, exactly,
With its emphasis on rights and mm-hmm, protections mm-hmm. of minorities mm-hmm. as opposed to democracy, which is about people power.
Right, right.
And he's emphasizing that people power mm-hmm. aspect of democracy.
Mm-hmm. And so you can have, you know, in ways that kind of reflect back on, you know, people we've talked with, like how democracies die, you can have very democratic, procedure that leads to very undemocratic or at least, you know, illiberal outcomes.
Well, that's what we're seeing with some of the populist movements across
right,
the globe right now.
Right. Yeah, and it is
regimes that are elected democratically, but then immediately govern in very illiberal sorts of ways, and change rules and policies in a way that downplays liberalism.
Right. And so he makes these same kind of connections back to, you know, the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution especially, where they started with this, you know, extreme hopes for and passion around the idea of, you know, the rights of man, you know, in France, and, you know, kind of stepping up to a new standing in the world for the individual and for the right of being able to have your say.
Certainly the American example, I think, is one where people have come to have a wider view of what democracy means and much more ambitious expectations about who will be involved in a democracy.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I mean, there is much that's undemocratic about the American Constitution. But the fact is that over time, the American politics have become more democratic. The franchise has been expanded to more and more groups.
And, you know, looking at it, you know, it's not an incredibly long book. Looking at it over 2,500 years, you really get a sense of just how contentious and how complicated this idea is. And I think that's a good segue as any to bring in Jenna and Jim and see and hear what they have to say.
Okay.
This is Jenna Spinelli here today with James Miller. James, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So your book, Can Democracy Work? It's kind of a quick fire history lesson of the past 2,500 years or so of the democratic experiment, as it were. But I actually want to start our conversation with something that you say at the end of the book, on the very last page, in fact. You talk about the ideal of democracy survives, even as it appears that the practice of democracy may be waning. I'm wondering if you could talk about what that ideal is and where it comes from.
Talking about democracy in 2019 is complicated because it has evolved in so many different directions, and different people in different contexts have defined it in different ways. And often people disagree vehemently about what is a kosher definition of democracy. So one of the reasons I wrote my book was to answer the riddle of how could a form of government, which was disparaged for most of human history, have emerged in the late 18th, 19th, and then 20th century to become the prevailing preferred form of regime, at least superficially. So my book is built around narrative accounts of five different answers to the question, what is democracy? But as I've gone around the country this fall, since the book was published and spoken about democracy, I've come to the conclusion that actually you can reduce all of these different definitions to variations on a core sort of spine of the category that goes all the way back to the first appearance of the term in ancient Athens. And the term itself in Greek is a conjunction of two words, demos and kratos. Demos is the Greek word for people. Kratos is a more interesting term in the archaic Greek, as I've come to understand. I don't talk about this in the book, but it came up when I was on a panel at Yale with a specialist in classical studies. Kratos means power, broadly understood, but it also has a strong connotation of force, of might. It's not just cuddly, abstract power. It really connotes people who have weapons in their hands and you have to respond to them. So a literal translation of the word democracy into English would be people power. And so I think that the backbone of democracy and the key tension in it is that in practice, going back to ancient Athens, it's implied the direct power of a people. But in application in modern societies, the power of the people has always been sharply attenuated and papered over. So you have a conflict between an ideal and what it would mean if you were to take it literally, and the kind of sad way it's put into practice in most existing regimes.
Sure, and it strikes me that kind of the theme of the book is looking at a kind of our struggles to find what the right balance between those things, those two forces that you describe are, at least to the extent that we even can. I mean, you also say that it's, I think you're quoting someone else here when you describe it as a cruel game without an end, right? So where, you know, I think as you show in your kind of historical examples, it's been this kind of, you know, back and forth and ebb and flow between those two things. But what can history tell us about trying to marry this ideal of democracy versus what it ends up being in practice?
Well, I first of all, I think it's very misleading to try to draw direct lessons from history. Because so much in politics is situational. It depends on the context. It depends on the culture. It depends on the level of development of a people or a group that's trying to become self-governing. In the modern period, the democracy as an idea and as an ideology and an ideal, it's inherently unstable because there's a core ambiguity about to what extent it can be realized in practice. And there's a further ambiguity in that it's proven to be a very powerful legitimating mechanism as an ideology. And you end up with regimes that talk about democracy, but don't for a nanosecond really mean it. And the cases of communist countries like North Korea and China are, to most Americans, self-evident. But the United States, to me, is a version of this. The United States has a constitution that was designed to thwart democracy. The founders intended to do that, and to this day, the Constitution, in effect, does do that by giving rural voters disproportionate power, the Senate, the Electoral College. There are many undemocratic features of the American Constitution. On the other hand, the one thing that everybody focuses on in America who wants to try to promote democracy is the right to vote. And yet, I don't think there's been a single time in American history when the right to vote, the franchise, has been universally exercised in this country, because there is a constant struggle to suppress votes, to take away voting rights from various groups for various reasons, whether it's literacy tests or racial discrimination, et cetera, et cetera. So the story of democracy in the modern world is a kind of trick-or-treat tale, I'm afraid. What most people forget is that foreigners were excluded. And Athens had a lot of foreigners. It was a huge commercial city, one of the biggest in the ancient world. And it would be like being in New York City and saying that anybody who is was not born in New York City to two New York City parents couldn't have any role in the politics of the city, because that was the rule in Athens. You had to have two native-born parents. It couldn't just be your mother or father. It had to be both. So this was a very rigorous and rigidly enforced exclusionary rule of citizenship. It had the great material benefit that it allowed the Athenian city-state to, in effect, redistribute wealth and support poor people, in part by paying them to participate in the running of the city's justice system and its political administration.
Right, this is your Council of
the Council of 500, right? People were paid to for jury duty, just as nominally they are in the United States today. But that I want to stress it, because that model of exclusionary, a kind of an exclusionary welfare state, has been reproduced today in countries like Hungary and Poland. And there's a tendency for people to say, oh, that's not democratic. And I think that's not right. Democracy from its inception as people power doesn't entail liberal protections. Those come later. The second case right. I look at is the case that seems to me very clearly to be the inflection point where democracy reappears as a defensible form of government, and the term begins to be used honorifically again. This happens in France after the storming of the Bastille in 1789, and the answer that the French give to the question, what is democracy, is a revolutionary assertion of popular sovereignty. They redefine democracy in terms of popular sovereignty. So we're talking about force and might and the exercise of popular might in a very direct way here. This insurrection clears the way for the creation of what's known as the French Convention, in which the great philosopher and mathematician and constitutionalist, the Marquis de Condorcet, creates what is the world's first democratic constitution, which is an attempt to actually figure out a way to create direct popular involvement in politics at the scale of a nation state.
The French are working, as you said, thousands of years after Athens, and your democracy had long been out of favor, out of kind of the thought that it was a good system of government, a good thing to pursue. So what are they looking to, or you know, where are they kind of getting some of these ideas that, you know, ended up in this constitution that, you know, was never ultimately ratified, but did end up, you know, influencing people on down the line?
The key intellectual influence is Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who grows out of a modern republican tradition and ends up backing into a kind of support for democracy, I think in part because he grew up in the city of Geneva, which had the dimensions of a Greek polis and had a constitution in the 18th century that was described as aristo-democratic. So it was already halfway to being presented to citizens as democratic. And Rousseau grew up aware of what was in fact in kind of slow burn civil war in the city that occasionally erupted into armed conflict over how democratic the city of Geneva's government should be. The principles of popular sovereignty as laid out in the social contract stipulate that you cannot represent the will of the people. So it's an explicit attack on representative government, particularly the English Constitution. So, you know, that is the proximate source of inspiration for what the revolutionaries in Condorcet were trying to accomplish in France. Rousseau also is interesting because he really is AWOL in the American Revolution. The Americans read Montesquieu and the Scottish Enlightenment and Locke and so on and so forth. But one of the reasons why democracy is AWOL during the founding is because of the lack of this key intellectual influence that becomes salient in the French Revolution. The French Revolution, by the way, also becomes a tremendous influence on the United States in the 1790s. And again, this is a story that isn't usually told. But people like Thomas Jefferson, who happened to be in Paris and watched as the Bastille was stormed and wrote back a report about what he saw, people like Jefferson were very enthused by the French Revolution. And the people in Jefferson's faction within the federal government were inspired by the rise of popular clubs and debating societies in France in the 1790s. And such popular societies began to sprout up in the United States, in which ordinary people would gather to discuss constitutional principles. and in which the newspapers that were controlled by the Jeffersonians were actually printing verbatim the entire speeches of Robespierre as soon as they could be brought by boat and translated and put into English. So there is an American version of democracy that does appear in the course of the 19th century, and it develops on a different path than democracy in Europe. And yet, we in the United States think we invented democracy. So one of the more weird facets of the story of modern democracy is America preening itself on being the birthplace of modern democracy, which is false, and being a place where we're the great protector of democracy, which we've used repeatedly in the 20th and 21st century as a rationale for imposing by gunfire democratic ideals on foreign countries. So the American answer to the question, what is democracy, I think is a commercial republic of free individuals. It's a libertarian market society version of democracy that's quite distinct from the social democratic version that emerges in Europe that stresses political and social equality.
Sure. There have also kind of been kind of experiments in more direct democracy along the way in America. I think we were all surprised to read about the People's Party and the People's Constitution in Rhode Island. Can you talk a little bit about what that looked like?
At the time of the Revolution, after the Declaration of Independence, most of the states, the colonies, drafted their own constitutions. But during this whole ferment, Rhode Island basically just ratified its colonial charter and kept it in place, which meant that in the 1830s, it was completely out of step with what was going on in other parts of the United States, which led one of the a scion of a political legacy family in Rhode Island to say, wait a minute, we need to create a broader franchise here in Rhode Island. And he marshaled support. He petitioned the legislature of Rhode Island, which ignored him, and in frustration said, okay, I'm going to declare a convention, and we're going to draft a new constitution, which, of course, by the rules of the state legislature in Rhode Island, was illegal. But he went ahead and did this. A huge number of citizens of Rhode Island participated in this convention. They then participated in a subsequent election that was organized illegally. And it led in an almost farcical manner to the takeover of an attempt to take over the state National Guard armory. By hauling cannons out and attacking it, and because the people who were involved actually had very few martial skills, it ends up short of a civil war. But it came to the brink of a civil war. And again, in the United States, it's odd to think that this would happen. But of course, this is before actually the big civil war over slavery. And part of what's sobering about what happened in Rhode Island is when they held an absolutely as democratic as possible vote, it turned out the majority of people in Rhode Island did not want to extend the franchise to black people. And so there's always this kind of contradiction. If you give real power to ordinary people, you don't necessarily know who they're going to include or exclude. So the Rhode Island affair was, when I discovered it, I was completely shocked because it seemed so un-American.
Right. And going from that notion of kind of knowing who people will exclude or won't exclude, or, kind of measuring what people think, you also talk about the rise of Gallup in the 30s and, public opinion polls, and kind of I'm utilizing those methods as a way to kind of help gauge what people are thinking and, how does this impact democracy, being able to, in a way that hadn't really been possible technically or otherwise, to know how broad swaths of the population felt.
The correct answer to the question, what is democracy in the 20th century, probably is a hall of mirrors, but the conception that allows that to happen is the notion that democracy is ruled by public opinion. And this is proposed as a definition of modern democracy by Woodrow Wilson in writings before he became president of the United States. I think to many of us, it's second nature by now. What Wilson didn't foresee, even though he was a very early PhD in political science, which was just emergent field in scholarship, is that around the time of the First World War, the Great War, there had been enough advances in statistics, and Condorcet, by the way, was a great pioneer of political arithmetic, as he called it. There had been enough advances in statistics that people had figured out that if you did random samples of individuals, you could get a broad gauge through probability sampling of what larger groups of people were thinking, and that these statistical samples would be more accurate than if you sent in, if you just asked people who all of whom read a magazine or to cast votes for something because of the randomness of the selection. This nascent science of the monitoring of public opinion takes root in the United States, first of all, in commercial applications through market research, but very quickly spreads to politics and emerges as a kind of set of practices in the 20s and into the 1930s, and finally in the 1936 presidential campaign, for the first time, you have newspapers and magazines printing public opinion polls on who supports the different presidential candidates for the first time in history. The hope of people like George Gallup, who whose Gallup poll was one of the most famous of these early polls and is still around, was that this would become a kind of snapshot of what the people wanted, and that there would have been created a device that, in a way, would, if you thought the public opinion polling was totally accurate, it could even bypass elections. It was like you could just have the pulse of the ordinary people without them having to do anything. Certainly, they wouldn't have to gather in a town square and pick up arms and have an insurrection. It was just almost the opposite of that. The problem with that idealized vision is there's been a recurrence, I would say, of these utopian hopes for monitoring what people want that you can track from Gallup all the way up to the early internet utopians who thought the internet would make possible a direct transcription of individual desires that you could aggregate and make a more democratic monitoring device, is that public opinion polling, it's a two-way street. You can find out what people think they want, and then you can try to manipulate it. And you can manipulate it in part by the questions you ask.
And this also ties to something, this is from Walter Lippmann, that people don't really have the time to devote to these issues anyway. They don't really understand what's happening in their democracy, why it's happening, or what should be happening. So this seems like an easy kind of way around it, but yeah, as you've said, maybe not always quite so easy.
There are two different types of problems facing modern democracy. One is an institutional problem of scale versus participation, which Robert Michels in the Iron Law of Oligarchy identified as a real problem. As you scale up institutions, ordinary people tend to have smaller and smaller potential for having a voice in those institutions. But the other limitation is psychological, is that human beings actually can only process so much information, and in a complicated modern society, an awful lot of the key information relevant to politics is invisible to ordinary citizens and has to be mediated through media, if they have access to it at all, given the rise of considerable areas of secrecy in the modern administrative state. Say, these are major challenges to democratic aspirations.
So what's the answer, or did you kind of glean anything about how to move forward, or what a more perfect form of democracy can look like based on, you know, all of these examples and everything you've culled from history?
So there's one question: is democracy a universal ideal solution to all in all political administrative domains? Really? Shouldn't we rethink that? Because what's happened is, I think, that under the ideology of democracy, there has evolved a number of hierarchical institutions that are, in fact, governed by meritocracy and rules of expertise. The other response I would say is that the vitality of democracy in a modern setting, in effect, depends on continued eruption into the public sphere of the voices of ordinary citizens, and that this eruption of voices will often be unruly and may even create chaos. That's the nature of democratic revolts. And in this context, I would say the following. I mean, on one level, you could look at the last 2 years in the United States and say, oh, this is terrible. I mean, there's been a great democratic recession and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I don't buy it. I think that I don't buy the idea there's been a great democratic recession globally. Most of the people who present those metrics conflate liberalism and democracy. There's been a popular revulsion against liberal norms, standards, and guardrails. That's something different. And in response to that popular uprising in response to liberal norms and institutions and guardrails, there has been an incredible mobilization. It's a struggle that's in process. It's not clear that the forces that back liberal guardrails and institutional protections are going to win. That's the nature of politics. It's a struggle. And that means that I have no sympathy for people who keep denouncing what they call populism, which to me just means it's people power that they don't like. It's a group of people who are advocating policies they disagree with. The democratic answer to that is you should marshal your own people power. And that's what's going on in the United States right now, in my view. It's a tremendous marshaling of political energies, the likes of which I haven't seen since the 1960s.
Well, Jim, there's a lot to chew on in this book, but I know I've certainly learned a lot, parts of history that I think we kind of gloss over in our own education.
Well,
so a lot to think about, and I think you do a great job of connecting those themes as you've done here during this conversation.
Yeah, well, thank you. And maybe our paths will cross some other place in some other way. It's been enjoyable.
Well, there's a lot to chew on
there,
Chris. I one thing that I was really intrigued by is the distinction Jim draws there between what he calls the commercial republic of the United States and the more democratic socialist
or social democrat.
Democratic democracies of Europe. And you know, he's making a very important point there that the American democracy is a different case.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and this is something that you hear, especially on the right, people referring to, you know, the American experiment, and they'll say,
exceptionalism? Yeah, is that what you're getting to?
Well, the idea that...
exceptionalism argument is, as I've always understood it, is one that because the American democracy did not evolve from an aristocracy, that we have a very different sort of democratic tradition.
So the argument that people on the right frequently make is that, you know, this is not a democracy, this is a republic. And, you know, in some ways, Jim's book reflects that, right? That the American, you know, his idea of the commercial republic, I don't remember which founder said that, but it was one of the founders. And the idea is that, you know, freedom has as much to do with, you know, your individual right to make a buck as it does, and to believe what you want, as it does to have some kind of power. However, I think you can overstate that. And you can also, you know, first of all, I mean, as you said, you have to understand the democratic dimensions of this document in the context of the times. And then you also have to see it as an evolving, conversation through history with respect to what do we mean by popular sovereignty.
Right. Well, and I read the Federalist Papers as an effort to come to grips with how do you form a democracy in a country that's going to grow.
Mm-hmm. And it's already very large.
And that's already very, very large.
3 million people.
And putting aside all of the non-democratic compromises that they made, you know, there is they do argue out to a certain extent with the anti-federalists the idea of whether or not democracy needs to be grounded in smaller locales. Mm-hmm. Where people can become more involved in decision making. I mean, that tradition was very much in the United States. Those are the New England town halls. They still do that mm-hmm. to some extent, where people come out and they talk about the actual issues. They vote on the budget. They do this for their schools. They do it for their town. So that was there. But the Federalists, I think, were trying to work out. But how does this work where you have a whole multitude of interests mm-hmm. and where you're actually going to have even more interest coming in as the country grows? And they come up with a somewhat elite-led
yes.
Sort of Republican democracy. I don't think it's fair not to say that it's a democracy, but it's a republic.
I agree with that.
It's a particular type of
right.
democracy.
So it's a subset, right. And I to make some kind of sharp distinction, you're either one or the other, I think is just – you know, wrong. I also think that as history has progressed, the distinction has gotten even more diminished. The third thing I would want to say is that, you know, I'm really kind of glad there's a Bill of Rights and that there is this liberal tradition within. I'm not kind of glad. I'm extremely glad that this liberal, foundation constrains democracy, right? Because without it, things that have happened in American history and that could happen at any moment that would create outcomes that none of us would want, right?
Right. Well, the sense that we're seeing in many democracies around the world that maybe the history of democracies really moves towards authoritarianism. Mm,
yeah, yeah.
Rather than towards, as maybe Martin Luther King might have said, towards justice.
Mm-hmm.
So, Chris, I was struck, too, by something Jim said about how so much having to do with democracy historically is contextual, and that you can't really generalize about, and I guess you can't really generalize about where democracies are going to succeed and when democracy is mm-hmm. going to succeed. Did you catch that as a representation?
Yeah, I mean, it actually kind of struck me as kind of an odd thing to say because the whole book is about looking at examples to kind of find out what's going on in democracies. And yeah, they're all idiosyncratic, but still there's...
Well, I'm also struck by books that we read. And actually, he referenced one quickly at the end, how democracies die and a lot of work that goes on in studies of democratization and political science sometimes refer to it as democratic consolidation. But let's go to how democracies die, which is something we talked about, which really actually tries to lay out fairly systematically mm-hmm. How it is that a democracy might die. Mm-hmm. And other work tries to lay out rather systematically the conditions that are necessary for a democracy to succeed. If a country has an educated middle class, it's more likely to be able to – a democracy is more likely to take root and grow. Countries that have greater extensions of rights to women are more likely perhaps for a democracy to grow.
Well, I think that's true. I think his argument with kind of the framing of a book with the title How Democracies Die, his argument is, you know, Putin has 80% approval rating in Russia, and Orban in Hungary was just reelected, as was Erdogan in Turkey. So the argument isn't that these are undemocratic, is that they're unliberal, and so it's just it's the wrong way to frame it.
Well, I think they're undemocratic too, and undemocratic because
you know, I picked up that I know that he's reluctant to reduce democracy to voting. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really appropriate. Mm-hmm. But there also it is possible to compare elections across countries in time and say that some are more democratic than others.
Yes.
Elections that have real opposition. Mm-hmm. Elections that allow a free press.
Right.
Elections that where assembly is allowed. Elections that don't restrict suffrage to only certain parts of the population. I mean, there are a lot of ways in which some elections are more democratic than others. Elections where a leader who squashes the opposition receives 80% of the vote, it's not a democratic election.
Yeah, and so what I'm hearing from you is something that I think is a really salient and important point. The idea is that the rights and freedoms that we understand as liberal are part and parcel of your understanding of popular sovereignty, right? So in other words, if you're going to give people the vote and people are going to freely express their opinion, then you need a free press. You need the ability of, you know, you need an opposition. You need an election that allows people to choose freely. And so you can't really have a democracy without this.
It's a very procedural view of democracy. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to minimize the point that he's making, too, that the power of people comes through in ways other than elections as well. And I mean, we've seen a lot of that in the United States mm-hmm. since the election of Donald Trump with the, as he mentioned, through the women's marches and through other kinds of protests. I think about what happened at the airports when the travel ban went in. But, you know, even there, you heard from many people, well, if this has turned into electoral power, then it really does make a difference. But if it doesn't, it's harder to see where it does.
Well, I think that's kind of true, right? Yeah. I mean, that is the elections are and have been from the time of the founding understood to be the means by which, the primary means by which the people exercise their sovereignty.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as we've talked about before, we seem to be at a moment, and Jim noted this, where people are really interested in democracy. They're talking about democracy. They're reading about it. And this is a terrific addition to anyone's library about how to understand American democracy and worldwide democracy.
Right. And I, you know, the themes that are in this book are ones that we have reflected on before and will continue to, because they're just central. So, thanks to Jenna and to Jim, and thank you all for listening. My name's Chris Beam.
I'm Michael Berkman.
And this is Democracy Works.
Democracy Works is produced by the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State and WPSU Penn State. Our hosts are Michael Berkman, Chris Beam, and me, Jenna Spinelli. Andy Grant is our engineer, and Mark Stitzer is our editor. Additional support comes from Emily Reddy, Shireen Stanford, Craig Johnson, and the rest of the team at WPSU. For detailed show notes and discussion questions for each episode, visit our website at democracyworkspodcast.com. And if you like what you heard today, please consider rating or reviewing us wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.